Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Hopefully this Friday is the Friday of the greatest joy, a Friday of victory for our Muslim brothers. This is a blessed Friday.
In Syria, tens of thousands crowd the Great Mosque of Damascus to attend the first Friday prayer since rebels toppled longtime authoritarian President Bashar al-Assad last Sunday. We'll go to Damascus to speak with Middle East Associated Press reporter Sara Aldeeb. Then today is the 75th day of a hunger strike by Leila Sway, the mother of the prominent British-Egyptian political prisoner Ala Abdel Fattah. She's calling on British officials to pressure Egypt for the release of her son. We'll speak to the Cairo University mathematics professor in London, where she's been standing outside the Foreign Office.
I'm definitely angry, really angry from the way things are happening, and of course angry about him continuing to be imprisoned. He wasn't supposed to be in jail for 5 years, let alone the 5 years before in his first jail term.
Then to Amale Yeshitela, longtime chair of the African People's Socialist Party and leader of the Uhuru movement. He's due to be sentenced to prison Monday after a Florida jury found him and two others known as the Uhuru Three guilty of conspiring to act as Russian agents, but cleared them of actually doing so.
A jury determined that we were not Russian agents, and which meant, of course, that they agreed that the only thing we'd ever done is work for the liberation of African people, on the one hand. On the other hand, they convicted us of conspiracy to do something that never happened.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Syria, tens of thousands of people have gathered at the Great Mosque of Damascus and other cities across the country for the first Friday prayers since longtime authoritarian President Bashar al-Assad was toppled by opposition fighters. The World Food Program's appealing to donors to help it scale up relief operations for some 2.8 million displaced and food insecure Syrians. That includes more than 1.1 million people uprooted by fighting since late November. Israel's defense minister has told his troops to prepare to spend the winter holding the demilitarized zone that separates Syria from the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Earlier today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu toured the summit of Mount Haramun in the UN-designated buffer zone. Netanyahu said this week the Golan Heights would, quote, forever be an inseparable part of the state of Israel, unquote. On Thursday, the UN called for an urgent de-escalation of airstrikes in Syria by Israeli forces and their withdrawal from the UN buffer zone.
The Secretary General is deeply concerned by the recent and extensive violations of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The Secretary General is particularly concerned over the hundreds of Israeli airstrikes on several locations in Syria, stressing the need, the urgent need, to de-escalate violence on all fronts throughout the country.
In Ankara, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Turkey's foreign minister and the president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Blinken said the U.S. and Turkey would work to prevent a resurgence of the Islamic State in Syria. Meanwhile, Erdogan told Blinken Turkey reserves the right to strike the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces led by the Kurdish People's Protection Units, or YPG, which Turkey considers a terrorist organization. After headlines, we'll go to Damascus for the latest on Syria. in Gaza. An Israeli airstrike on Thursday ripped through a post office sheltering displaced Palestinian families in the Nusayrat refugee camp, killing at least 33 Palestinians, with 84 others wounded or missing. Elsewhere, separate Israeli strikes killed at least 13 people in Rafah and Khan Yunis. Palestinian medics said those killed were part of a force protecting humanitarian aid trucks. This comes as a new study finds 96% of children in Gaza feel their death is imminent, and nearly half said they wish to die. 4 out of 5 children surveyed suffer from nightmares. Nearly 3/4 show signs of aggression. The study was conducted by the charity War Child Alliance, which said in a statement, quote, alongside the leveling of hospitals, schools and homes, a trail of psychological destruction has caused wounds unseen, but no less destructive on children who hold no responsibility for this war, unquote. Meanwhile, Reporters Without Borders warns Palestine remained the most dangerous country in the world for journalists this year. Since October 2023, Israeli attacks have killed more than 145 media workers, which the group condemned as an unprecedented bloodbath, unquote. Palestinian press freedom groups have put the number even higher at nearly 200 journalists killed by Israel. Russia's launched a massive missile and drone attack targeting Ukraine's energy grid, sending Kyiv residents underground to seek shelter in the city's metros. This is a mother and daughter who are displaced from Kherson due to the war.
Of course, I would rather be going to work and have my child go to school now. But as you can see yourself, air raid alert is issued and we had to go to the shelter to hide from the missiles. It is very difficult, of course. Every night there is an air alarm. My child is always scared.
On Thursday, Moscow reissued its threat to retaliate against a Ukrainian attack on a southwestern Russian city, which it says involved U.S.-made ATACMS ballistic missiles. Meanwhile, the U.S. says Russia could soon launch another strike using an intermediate-range hypersonic missile that was deployed for the first time last month. In South Korea, a second motion to impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol was submitted to the parliament today over Yoon's declaration of martial law on December 3rd. Yoon was forced to reverse the order just 6 hours later amidst widespread outrage and protest. An earlier impeachment motion failed to remove Yoon after much of his ruling People Power Party boycotted the vote. Street protests demanding his removal are continuing. French President Emmanuel Macron has appointed centrist ally François Bayrou as prime minister, following the collapse of the previous government in a no-confidence vote. In choosing Bayrou, Macron once again eschewed widespread calls for him to select a progressive prime minister after a leftist coalition won the largest share of votes in July's snap parliamentary elections. At The Hague, the International Court of Justice has heard more testimony and arguments this week on how the unfolding climate catastrophe is creating an existential crisis for low-lying Pacific Island nations. Those countries are demanding wealthy, polluting nations be held legally responsible for addressing the crisis they created. This is Langene Italele Talia, the Attorney General of Tuvalu, which could soon become the first country to be wiped from the face of the earth due to sea level rise.
Tuvalu may soon become uninhabitable. In these circumstances, there can be no question that our fundamental right to self-determination is being violated. And in these proceedings, there is unsurprisingly considerable consensus across participants that climate change is impeding the right to self-determination.
Today is the last day of hearings at the World Court, which is expected to publish its final advisory opinion on the matter in the new year. In Washington, D.C., police arrested 13 people on Thursday as they nonviolently blockaded the headquarters of the Department of Energy, demanding the Biden administration cancel authorizations for new liquefied natural gas export terminals. Activists say greenhouse gas emissions from the proposed exports would be equivalent to 1,000 coal-fired power plants.
I'm a mom and a teacher, and I feel like I owe it to my daughter and my students. I got to be able to sleep at night to go to work and teach them. And I can't sleep at night if I don't do everything in my power to stop what's currently happening.
A new investigation by the Marshall Project finds hospitals across the U.S. are dispensing medications to patients in labor only to report them to child welfare authorities when they or their newborns test positive for those very same substances on drug tests. Federal law requires hospitals report positive positive drug test to ensure babies who need it can receive treatment for withdrawal. But amidst the increased criminalization of reproductive health care, health experts say hospitals need to put into place more patient safeguards around drug testing. Hospital reports based on the misleading drug tests have led to investigations and even the removal of children from their parents. Luigi Mangione, the suspect in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York, is fighting his extradition from Pennsylvania, where he was arrested by authorities Monday. Mangione's lawyer says they're waiting for more evidence related to the charges against him in New York. Meanwhile, the NYPD warned healthcare executives earlier this week after a hit list of CEOs was posted online. Wanted posters popped up across New York this week featuring photos of health insurance CEOs as the case has galvanized public condemnation of the health insurance industry. In related news, a woman in Florida was arrested and charged this week for threatening to conduct a mass shooting or an act of terrorism after she ended a call to her insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield, with the words, delay, deny, depose. Those three words were found written on bullet casings at the scene of Brian Thompson's shooting. Delay, deny, and defend are known as the three Ds of the health insurance industry. Here in New York, immigrant justice activists rallied outside City Hall to protest Mayor Eric Adams' meeting with Trump's incoming border czar Tom Homan, who's vowed to enact Trump's plans for mass deportations. This is Jennifer Hernandez of Make the Road New York.
El alcalde debería de negarse a colaborar con...
The mayor should refuse to collaborate with the federal government in the separation of families and make that clear to Tom Homan.
Mayor Adams has said he'll cooperate with federal immigration authorities, threatening New York's current status as a sanctuary city. A Palestinian-American man who was convicted and imprisoned in 2008 for his work with the charity Holy Land Foundation has been released from federal prison. Mufid Abdelkader, one of the so-called Holy Land Five, was released to a halfway house on Thursday. Abdelkader and his four co-defendants, Hassan Elashi, Shukri Abubakar, Mohammed El Mazain, and Abdurrahman Odeh, received sentences up to 65 years under the Bush administration, accused of working for a terrorist organization. The Holy Land Foundation raised millions of dollars for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation, making it a target for pro-Israel groups in the U.S. Their case was widely denounced as political persecution during the height of the so-called War on Terror and shuttered what was once the largest Muslim charity in the U.S. Shukri Abubakar and Hassan Elashi remain behind bars. Police arrested at least eight protesters at the campus of New York University Thursday as they nonviolently blockaded the university's library to demand NYU divest from companies that profit from Israel's war and occupation of Palestine. Among those arrested were two faculty members, history professor Rebecca Carl and American Studies professor Andrew Ross. They're among six professors and dozens of students who've been declared persona non grata by campus security officials and barred from entering NYU buildings. And New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy has signed a bill to prevent book bans as Republican lawmakers in many other states are working to ban a record number of books from school library shelves, most of them dealing with gender identity, sexual orientation, and racial justice. At the signing ceremony this week, Governor Murphy was introduced by Martha Hickson, a retired high school librarian from Annandale, New Jersey, who endured verbal abuse from some parents who objected to LGBTQ theme books in the school library.
According to School Library Journal, nearly half of school librarians reported they had quietly removed books themselves to avoid being the target of a challenge. And those are just the librarians who admitted it. I suspect the number is actually much higher. And I know teachers who will no longer include controversial topics or titles in their classrooms for fear of being targeted too. When this self-censorship happens, it's the students who suffer. They lose the voices and stories that explore the real world beyond their own front door. Our own fear censors the material, so book banners don't have to.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Syria, where tens of thousands of people have gathered at the Great Mosque of Damascus for the first Friday prayers since longtime authoritarian President Bashar al-Assad was toppled by opposition fighters.
Hopefully this Friday is the Friday of the greatest joy, a Friday of victory for our Muslim brothers. This is a blessed Friday.
Syria's new caretaker prime minister, Mohammed al-Bashir, was among those at the mosque. He'll act as prime minister until March. This comes as the World Food Program is appealing to donors to help it scale up relief operations for the approximately 2.8 million displaced and food insecure Syrians across the country. That includes more than 1.1 million people who are forcibly displaced by fighting since late November. Israel's defense minister has told his troops to prepare to spend the winter holding the demilitarized zone that separates Syria from the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Earlier today, Prime Minister Netanyahu toured the summit of Mount Haramun in the UN-designated buffer zone. Netanyahu said this week the Golan Heights would, quote, forever be an inseparable part of the State of Israel, unquote. On Thursday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an urgent de-escalation of airstrikes on Syria by Israeli forces and their withdrawal from the UN buffer zone. In Ankara, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Turkey's foreign minister and the president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Blinken said the U.S. and Turkey would do to prevent a resurgence of the Islamic State group in Syria. Meanwhile, Erdogan told Blinken that Turkey reserves the right to strike the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, led by the Kurdish People's Protection Units, or YPG, which Turkey considers terrorist. For more, we go to Damascus for the first time since the fall of longtime authoritarian President Bashar al-Assad, where we're joined by the Associated Press investigative reporter Sarah El-Deeb, who's based in the Middle East, a region she's covered for two decades. Sarah, welcome to Democracy Now! You are overlooking the square where tens of thousands of Syrians have gathered for the first Friday prayers since the fall of Assad. Describe the scene for us.
There is a lot of first here. It's the first time they gather on Friday after Bashar al-Assad fled the country. It's the first time everyone seems to be very happy. I think that's the dominant sentiment, especially people who are in the square. There's ecstasy, tens of thousands of people. They're still chanting down with Bashar al-Assad, but what's new is that it's also visible that the sentiment is they've been so far happy with the new rulers, not outpour. There is no criticism, loud criticism of the new rulers yet. So I'd say that the dominant thing is that everyone's happy down there.
Sarah El-Deeb, you recently wrote an AP article headlined, "Thousands Scour Syria's Most Horrific Prison But Find No Sign of Their Loved Ones." On Tuesday's families of disappeared prisoners continued searching Sabnaya prison for signs of their long-lost loved ones who were locked up under Assad's brutal regime.
I will show you the photo of my missing brother. It's been 14 years. This is his photo. I don't know what he looks like if I find him. I don't know what he looks like because I am seeing the photos of prisoners getting out. They are like skeletons. But this is his photo. If anyone has seen him, can know anything about him, or can help us, he is one of thousands of prisoners who are missing. I am asking for everyone, not only my brother, uncle, cousin, and relatives.
Talk about this mad search by Syrians across the country.
This is the other scene that's been dominating our coverage and our reporting since we arrived here. The contrast between the relief, the sense of relief over the departure of Bashar al-Assad, but then the sadness and the concern and the no answers for where the loved ones have gone. Thousands, also tens of thousands of people have marched on Sabnaya. It's the counter to this scene where people were looking for any sign of where their relatives have been. As you know really well, so many people have reported their relatives missing, tens of thousands since the beginning of the revolt, but also before. I mean, I think this is part of the feature of this government is that there has been a lot of security crackdown. People were scared to speak, but they were, because there was a good reason for it. They were picked up at any expression of discontent or expression of opinion. So we were in Sabnaya 2-3 days ago. It feels like one big day, I have to say. When we were in Sabnaya, people were also describing what anything from the smallest expression of opinion, a violation of a traffic light, no answers, and they still don't know where their loved ones are. I mean, I think we know quite a lot from research before arriving here about the notorious prison system in Syria. There's secret prisons, there are security branches where people were being held. I think this is the first time we have an opportunity to go look at those facilities. What was surprising and shocking to the people, and also to a lot of us journalists, was that we couldn't find any sign of these people. I think, and the answers are, we're still looking for them, but what was clear is that only a handful, I mean, not a handful, hundreds of people were found. Many of them were also found in morgues. There were apparent killing at the last hours of before the regime departed. One of them was the prominent activist, Mazen Hamada, that we were at his funeral yesterday. He was found, and his family believes that he was found killed, and his family believes his body was fresh. He was killed only a few days earlier. So I think the killing continued up until the last hour.
I was wondering if you can tell us more about Mazen. I mean, I wanted to play a clip of Mazen's nephew, Yahya al-Hussein.
In 2020, he was taken from the Netherlands to Germany through the Syrian embassy there. And from there, they brought him to Syria with a fake passport. He arrived at the airport at around 2:30 a.m. and called my aunt to tell her that he arrived at the airport and asked for money. When they reached out to him the next day, they were told that air intelligence had arrested him.
That's Mazen's nephew, Yahya al-Hussein. Sarah, if you can explain, this was an activist who left Syria after he had been imprisoned and tortured, right, more than a decade ago, but ultimately came back, apparently according to assurances that he would not be retaken, and now his body found.
I mean, I think it's like you were saying, it's very hard to explain. This is someone who was very outspoken and was working on documenting the torture and the killing and the secret prisons in Syria. So he was very well aware of his role and his position vis-a-vis the government. Yet he felt it was hard to explain what Mazen's decision was based on, but his family believes he was lured into Syria by some false promises of security and safety. I mean, his heart was in Syria. He left Syria. It never left him. He was working from wherever he was. He was in the Netherlands. He was in the U.S. I think to expose these crimes. And I think these are the words of his family. He was a witness on the crimes of the Assad government, and he was a martyr of the Assad government. One of the people that were at the funeral yesterday was telling us Mazen was a lesson. The Assad government was teaching all Detainees a lesson through Mazen to keep him silent. I think it was just a testimony to how cruel this ruling regime, ruling system has been for the past 50 years. People would go back to his father's rule also. But I think with the revolution, with the protest in 2011, all these crimes and all these detentions were just en masse. I think the estimates are for anywhere between 150,000 and 80,000 detainees that no one can account for. That is on top of also all the people that were killed in airstrikes and in opposition areas in crackdown on protests. So it was surprising that at the last minute, it was surprising and yet not very surprising. When I asked the family, why did they do that? They would look at me and like, why are you asking this question? They do that, that's what they did. It was difficult to understand how even at the last minute, and even for someone that they promised security, this would be the end. Emaciated and tortured and killed, unfortunately.
Sarah, you spoke in Damascus to a U.S. citizen, Travis Timmerman, who says he was imprisoned in Syria. This is a clip from an interview with Al Arabiya Thursday, in which he says he spent the last 7 months in a prison cell in Damascus.
My name is Travis.
Travis.
Yes.
So, إذن وصلنا إلى شخص يدعى Travis. Travis Timmerman.
That's right.
That's right.
But just Travis. Just call me Travis.
Yeah, call you Travis. That's okay. Travis. Where were you all this time?
I was imprisoned in Damascus for the last 7 months. I was imprisoned in a cell by myself, and in the early morning of this Monday, or the Monday of this week, they took a hammer and they broke my door down. Well, the armed men just wanted to get me out of my cell, and then really the man who I stuck with was a Syrian man named Ely, who was also a prisoner that was just freed. And he took me by the side, by the arm, really, and he and a young woman that lives in Damascus. And us three exited the prison together.
Saraldeeb, your AP report on Timmerman is headlined, American pilgrim imprisoned in Assad, Syria, calls his release from prison a blessing. What can you share about him after interviewing him?
I spent quite a bit of time with Travis last night before, last night. And I think his experience was very different from what I was just describing. He was detained for crossing illegally into Syria. And I think his description of his experience was that it was okay. He was not mistreated. He was fed well. I mean, especially when I compare it to what I heard from the Syrian prisoners in the secret prisons or in detention facilities. He would receive rice, potatoes, tomatoes. None of this was available to the Syrian detainees. He would go to the bathroom three times a day, although this was uncomfortable for him because, of course, it was not whenever he wanted. But it was not something that other Syrian detainees would experience. His experience also was that he heard a lot of beating and a lot of beating. I think that's what he described it as, beating from nearby cells. They're mostly Syrian detainees. For him, that was an implicit threat of the use of violence against him, but he did not get any, he was not beaten or tortured.
And
he Sarah, also said his release was a blessing.
If you could also talk about Austin Tice, the American freelance journalist. His family, his mother and father and brothers and sisters seem to be repeatedly saying now that they believe he's alive, held by the Syrian government, and they're desperately looking for him or reaching out to people in Syria. What do you know?
What we know is that people thought Travis was Tice when they first saw him. They found him in a house in a village outside of Damascus. And I think that's what triggered. We didn't know that Travis was in a Syrian prison. So I think that's where everyone was going to check. They thought that this was Tice. I think the search, the U.S. administration, the family, they're all looking and determined to look for Tice. The family believes that he was in Syrian government prison. He entered Syria 2012. He is a journalist. But I think we have his family. Seem to think that he's still in the Syrian government prison, but I think so far we have not had any sign of Tice in from all those released. But mind you, the scenes of release from prisons was chaotic from multiple prisons at the same time, and we're still day by day finding out about new releases and people who were set free on that Sunday morning.
Finally, Saraldeeb, you've reported on the Middle East for decades. You just wrote a piece for AP titled, "These Palestinians Disappeared After Encounters with Israeli Troops in Gaza." So we're pivoting here. So much attention is being paid to the families of Syrians, prisoners who they are finally freeing. Want to turn to Gaza. Tell us about the Palestinians searching for their family members who went missing during raids and arrests by Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip. And talk about the lack of accountability for these appearances. You begin your piece with Rima Jour's quest to find her missing husband and daughter.
I talked to Rima Jour for a long time. I mean, I think, like you said, this was a pivot, but the themes have been common across the Middle East, sadly. Rima Jour last saw her family in March of 2024. Both her husband and her five-year-old daughter were injured after an Israeli raid on their house during the chaotic scenes of the Israeli raids on the Shifa Hospital. They lived in the neighborhood, so it was chaotic. They entered their home, and they were shooting in the air, or they were shooting, and the family ended up wounded. But what was striking was that the Israeli soldiers made the mother leave the kid wounded in her house and forced her to leave to the south. I think this is not only Rima Jour's case. I think this is something we've seen quite a bit in Gaza, but the fact that this was a five-year-old and the mom couldn't take her with her was quite moving. And I think what her case kind of symbolizes is that during these raids and during these detentions at checkpoints, families are separated, and we don't have any way of knowing how the Israeli military is actually documenting these detentions, these raids. Where do they, how do they account for people who they detain and then they release briefly?